It's the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast. I'm Christy Wilhelmi. Thanks for joining us. And welcome to our new podcast format where we spend time chatting with expert gardening guests to ask for their favorite tip. My guest today is Nan Sturman, host, co-producer, and co-writer of A Growing Passion, a television show that explores how plants power the world, which is awesome. She's also a garden designer, botanist, award-winning writer, and has a new book called Hot Color, Dry Garden, Inspiring Designs and Vibrant Plants for the Waterwise Gardener. Welcome to the Garden Nerd Podcast, Nan.
Thank you, Christy. I'm so glad to talk with you.
I am too. You know, we know each other through the Garden Writers Association, and we've also done a talk together on growing, specifically in Southern California, but we haven't really had time to chat outside of that. So I have so many questions, and I'm really excited. But first, I want to start with A Growing Passion, your TV show. Can you tell us how that show got started? How do you ended up doing it?
Oh, it's a long story. essentially, I was the garden editor for the San Diego Home Garden Lifestyle magazine, and I got to visit and interview gardeners all the time. And I wrote pretty good stories, but you know, there's nothing like seeing somebody's face and talking to them about their garden and how excited they get. And I thought, you know, video is the right medium for doing this. And so that was the original idea. But over the years, I've been involved in green, if you will, green issues for many, many years. And over the years, that evolved. And I am a botanist by training. I am an educator. And I love when, you know, I can present something to people and their eyes pop and they go, oh my God, I had no idea.
Yeah.
And so all of that together, because I have the knowledge about plants and how they power our world, and so it all came together, and suddenly we're doing a show. Well, suddenly, we got to the point where we were doing a show about plants in the world, in gardens, on farms, in nurseries, in habitat, in the science lab. You know, there's so many places. If you look around us, plants are everywhere. They're everything to us. They're what we wear. They're what we build with. They're what we eat. They are medicines. They make the oxygen we breathe. They cool our climate. They are our medications, our perfumes. What would we be without plants? And that's really what I want people to come away with.
That's fantastic. I love it. I specifically wanted to ask you about the hoop house that you're growing, because you grow fruits and vegetables in a hoop house in San Diego, and because you have critters, right?
Yes.
Tell me about what is this? What's the construction like? Give our listeners a little bit of a visual to go with this.
So for many, many years, I have grown vegetables in raised beds. For 30 plus years, I've grown vegetables in raised beds and wood raised beds. And they're long, you know, they're maybe 15 or 16 feet long. I have several of them and they're 4 feet wide, which is the optimum width. I can reach the center. Length doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have critters. You have visitors. You have possums and rats and mice and squirrels and you know, all kinds of things that come and visit the garden. And that's fine. I always plant enough to share. But in the last several years, they've been getting much more than I get. In fact, it got to the point where I would start my vegetable seeds. I would have my precious seedlings. I'd put them into the garden beds. And the next morning, the plants were eaten down to the soil line. I mean, there was nothing left.
Ugh, that's horrible.
Horrible. And for years, I tested seeds for Organic Gardening magazine, too. So here I have, you know, a huge audience waiting to hear about how these vegetables are doing, and the plants are disappearing. So not only was I frustrated that I wasn't able to grow the plants and harvest the produce that I love, it was a little embarrassing, you know?
Yeah.
Because they kept disappearing, and you could only do so much with traps. It was just overwhelming. So I decided that what I wanted to do was to build a room, you know, basically enclose my entire vegetable garden. And at that point, it was about 20 by 20. That's not a small space. I talked to my son, who's a contractor. I wanted him to build a room, you know, like wood posts and an 8-foot-high ceiling and the whole thing, and just cover it with hardware cloth, basically make it a big exclusion cage.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When we talked about it, he said, you know, the problem is that putting hardware cloth, which is the mesh that has those little squares, it's not chicken wire. Chicken wire has the big openings, and that's big enough that a mouse can get through and a baby rat can get through. We really needed to use chicken wire. I mean, sorry, hardware cloth.
Right, yeah. which is a stupid name for what it is, because the name does not invoke the image of what hardware cloth is. It's welded wire mesh, like usually half inch or something like that.
That's exactly right.
Right.
And the weight of it across the top would have required a post in the middle. That would have been right in the middle of one of my vegetable beds, and that just wasn't going to work for me.
Mm.
So he also offered, like, to make individual cages over each raised bed. That would not work. I mean, that would be a pain in the you-know-what.
Yeah, it's really hard to climb in there.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, how do you open it? And if you have something that's tall, like beans or tomatoes, I mean, how do you make it tall enough? It just didn't make any sense to me. So I was in one of the wholesale nurseries one day shopping for a design project, and I was talking to the guy who runs the nursery. This is a big wholesale grower, and the guy, he's a friend of mine, and over his shoulder, I noticed the hoop houses. You know, I've looked at those a million times. I just never really paid attention to them, but they're metal arches in a series connected and covered with plastic in the case of a nursery. And
right.
All the plants, you know, all the plants that need some protection are growing underneath that. And I looked at it and went, huh. I said to him, how wide are those? And he said, they're about 20 feet wide and they're freestanding, right?
That's so perfect.
Right? So I said, well, where do you get those metal rib things? And he says, oh, I've got a guy who makes them for me. He, you know, lives right near here. So I called the guy, and the guy came over, and I told him what I wanted him to do. And he looked at me like I was, you know, a little bit off my rocker, but hey, I'm used to that. So he said, sure, I can make you a hoop house. You know, I can make you the frame, and I can cover it. And so then I had to find the right kind of wire mesh, because I wanted half-inch wire mesh. The reason I wanted half-inch is because I wanted a size that would keep the rats and the mice out, but let the bees and the pollinators in.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really important. So I ended up having to order that because I needed extra wide rolls, blah, blah, blah. But these three guys showed up last August, and one day they set the poles, the next day they put the ribs on, started covering it, the third day they finished covering it, and oh my God, this summer I have a vegetable garden.
Woohoo!
Tell you how exciting it is. It's such a funny thing, but everything's growing and producing, and yay!
That's such a great idea. I see, you know, I get like farm tech catalog every once in a while for farmers, and nobody thinks about using hoop houses for backyard gardens. They just think about it for farming and that kind of thing. So that's genius,
yeah,
man.
Thanks. It's desperation. And, you know, desperation actually, it makes you think outside the box, if you will. And I just had to come up with something that would allow me to continue growing vegetables. I can't live without growing vegetables.
Yeah, I think that's it's why I do what I do, for sure. And I'm sure part of what you do. Well, actually, this leads into my next question really well, which is I think of your primary focus as drought-tolerant and water-wise gardens. And that's especially the focus of your new book, which I can't honestly help but say it like a sizzling romance novel. Hot color, dry garden.
I love it.
And it, you know, that book, from what I understand, guides people towards smart design choices for low water conditions. Where did you come up for the idea for this book?
You know, I'm born and raised in Southern California, so I've always known that water was limited, even though they taught us in school that, you know, water comes in there's the aqueduct and we have as much as we need, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I just never believed it. Who knows why? But, you know, as a conscious adult and having lived through the Back to the Land movement and all that stuff, I've always been really aware of how limited our resources are. And literally from the time I was a teenager, I had two categories of gardening. One focus was vegetables and the other was beautiful ornamentals. I'm a plant nerd, you know, I'm not just a garden nerd, I'm a plant nerd. But I'm also aware that water is really limited. And so one of my goals for the last 30 years in my ornamental gardens is to see how little water I can use to make a really beautiful garden. And that has become much, much more and more important, especially in the last several years as we've lived through drought, et cetera, to really focus on using plants that require the least amount of water to thrive in our climate.
Yeah, it's really important.
It is. At the same time, those plants and those gardens have to be beautiful. Otherwise, people won't do it.
Yes. And it's so, you know, I've seen such horrible, and I'm sure you have too, horrible drought-tolerant landscaping done wrong. You know, we have the result of what was turf terminators who came in and did what we call moonscaping around here, which is like five plants and a bunch of gravel.
But it was done poorly too.
Yeah. So, what are the basic design strategies that you are guiding people toward in your book?
Well, there's a number of them. The focus of this book, one of the concerns that people have, as long as I've been talking about water-wise gardening, one of the first things that people say is, oh no, I can't do that. I have to have color. Mm-hmm. Because there are some things that a dry garden, in other words, a dry garden meaning one you don't have to water very much, one that Mother Nature primarily waters, is going to be a brown, drab garden. Mm-hmm. There is nothing further from the truth. Water-wise plants are incredibly colorful, and it's not just the plants that bring color to the garden. You start with a colorful background. My house, if you go look online, you'll see photos of my house, is terracotta colored. It's not white. It could be brown, but I learned over the years that when you start with a colored background, I love the earth tones, terracottas, brown, sages, you know, those kinds of colors, but it could be any color. If you start with a colored background, you set the scene for a colorful presentation.
That's a good start.
Right. So you start with that, and then you bring in plants that whose colors complement the background. If you have, like what I have, terracotta, anything goes with that. Mm-hmm. But then you also add colorful accessories and all kinds of elements, colored walls that make a whole environment that's filled with color. The plants are one component, an important component, but one component of an overall perspective.
And I noticed that you don't just stick to California natives, but you're also including plants from Australia and Mexico. Right. Are the plants in the book specific to Mediterranean climates, or will they work elsewhere?
It's a very good question. What I focused on was climates that have a very low precipitation rate. In other words, limited rainfall climates. So there's two main categories of those. One is the Mediterranean climate like ours, mm-hmm. where we get all of our rainfall between November and March or April. And that's the flip side of that. What's really important to know is that we don't get rain from April till November.
Yeah.
That's what's really important. Now, in the deserts, in Arizona, New Mexico, et cetera, they get summer monsoon rains. So while the rainfall of San Diego, for example, and Tucson is about the same, Tucson's a little bit higher, when we get that rain is different. So plants that evolve in the deserts thrive in a climate where when it's hot, it's wet. Mm. So a lot of times people will say to me, well, I buy plants, you know, online from the desert websites, blah, blah, blah. Well, you've got to be really careful because... Especially when it comes to like perennials, those plants are not going to make it through our summer without being irrigated.
Right. And so you use drip irrigation in your landscape designs?
Yes, absolutely. I always have. In my own garden too, I always have.
Good. And what are some of your favorite plants for color and show?
So many.
I know, it's like choosing a favorite child, but...
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's a very good analogy. You know, our California natives are not especially colorful.
Yeah.
You have, like, ceanothus, which brings incredible color in, you know, California lilac. In the spring, you have encilia, those little yellow daisies. Mm-hmm. But our plants in general are not real color plants. To get to the real color water-wise plants, from you have to look to the other Mediterranean climates, primarily South Africa and Australia. Mm. And some of the best are those in the Protea family. So that is the cone bushes, the pincushions, grevilleas. Those three in particular, those three groups of plants, the colors they bring to the garden are fantastic.
Right. There's lots of reds and corals and pinks and even whites with some of the Proteas. They're yes. Gorgeous.
Right. Yellow. The leaves can be gray, blue-gray, bright green. The textures of the leaves are feathery to broad. I mean, the variety is fantastic. So I love to mix. I do what I call mixed Mediterranean. California natives, the natives to the Mediterranean region, which of course include those wonderful herbs we love, oregano, bay, lavender, rosemary. Mm-hmm. The plants native to Australia and South Africa, and even plants native to the west coast of Chile. Then we've got all those Mediterranean climates, plus plants from the deserts of Mexico and from Arizona. And you make this just really interesting combination of plants that do beautifully in a garden and are beautiful in a garden together.
Excellent. Well, I think everyone should go out and get your book, and we'll promote that at the end. Right now, though, it is tip time. Is there a favorite tip that you would like to share with the Garden Nerd audience?
Absolutely. This time of year, when it's really, really hot, often at the end of the day, our plants are really droopy. Mm-hmm. And of course, everyone wants to water, but that's not necessarily what you need to do. Plants are droopy at the end of the day because all day long, plants are losing water out of their leaves into the air. And the roots are pulling water out of the soil to replace that water. But when it's hot, the roots don't really, they can't keep up with the rate at which water is leaving the leaves. So more water leaves the leaves, and the roots are still pumping away, but they just haven't been able to keep up. Overnight, the plants stop photosynthesizing, the air cools a little bit, the water loss decreases, and the roots can catch up. So in the morning, your plants aren't droopy anymore.
Right. I always tell people to come out after the sun's gone down and check their plants, because they're usually perky again a couple hours after the heat of the day is over, especially things like tomatoes, where they just, everyone rushes out to water them when they're droopy, but it's just the defense mechanism of the plant.
Yes. It's literally a physical issue, because the water is leaving the leaves. And so there's not so much water, and the leaf starts to basically collapse. You don't have as much cell rigidity.
Yeah.
So the thing is, I would even take it a step further from what you said. Go out in the morning. The leaves should look perfectly fine.
Right. Everything's perky in the morning. But if it's droopy, certainly before the heat of the day, if they're droopy in the morning, then things need water.
That's exactly right.
Right.
So
yes.
Worry about droopy afternoons. Worry about droopy mornings.
Got it.
That sounds a little, well, anyway. Don't worry about droopy afternoon. Don't worry about droopy morning.
Well, you did write a hot romance novel of a book here.
Maybe they should have two bathtubs side by side on the front cover next time.
I love it. Yeah, that's a great idea. Well, thank you for sharing that expert tip, Nan. And thank you for being on the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast. It's been a delight.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been my pleasure.
Yay. All right, garden nerds, you'll find info on Nan's book, Hot Color, Dry Garden, at gardennerd.com this week. We'll share a link to her show, A Growing Passion, where you can watch every episode online, whether you are a San Diego resident or not. We'll also post a few of her favorite plants to incorporate into your own garden and share her Facebook groups and social media handles. That's it for this week. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen. Visit us for tons of gardening information on gardennerd.com. You'll find us on Instagram and Twitter at gardennerd1, on Facebook as gardennerd.com, and of course, our Garden Nerd YouTube channel. Happy gardening!